Chris.
Hi, Farah. So what exciting quickfire round have you got for me this week?
This week, it's all about business and the world of work. Zoom calls or face-to-face?
Face-to-face. Every single day of the week. I think I've had enough Zoom calls over the past 6 months to last me for a lifetime.
Amazon or the high street?
Of course, I should say the high street, but I actually hate going to shops, so Amazon.
A more controversial one, Richard Branson or Alan Sugar?
I'm going to go Richard Branson, because I know he's had people give him a hard time at the moment, but I think Richard Branson has created an absolutely iconic brand in Virgin, and he's created a number of iconic businesses. In the days when we used to be able to fly, I used to really enjoy getting Virgin Atlantic.
Well, let's go to other forms of transport. Cycling or taking the tube to work?
I'm not a big fan of the tube, so cycling. Although I'm not really a big fan of cycling in London either, so the honest answer is neither, but I'm going to say cycling.
And finally, after work drink or after work gym?
A pint outside a pub in Soho is just one of life's great pleasures.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the No Bullshit Leadership podcast powered by Intelligence Squared. I'm Chris Hurst, author of No Bullshit Leadership, and in my day job, I'm global CEO of Havas Creative Group. Leadership is difficult, but not complicated. And in this series, I want to help you cut through the bullshit and get to the heart of modern leadership, which, put simply, is the power to get stuff done and make stuff happen. In each episode, I'm joined by different inspirational leaders who do just that, leading change in their worlds of business, technology, sports or politics. My guest today is the business leader, innovator and author Beth Comstock. We're speaking in a special live recording hosted by Founders Forum. Beth, you've spent nearly three decades at General Electric as Chief Marketing Officer and then Vice Chair of Innovation. Before that, you were President of Integrated Media at NBC Universal. Your vision and innovation transformed both companies. You championed GE's transformation into clean energy and spearheaded the creation of Hulu before video streaming became a household term. You've also written a book, Imagine It Forward, which is about courage and creativity in the face of change. And you're on the board of directors at Nike. Welcome to the podcast, Beth. Quite a CV.
Thanks, Chris. Great to see you. And I love the focus on no bullshit. I think that's something we both agree on.
I think we do. In three words, describe your leadership style.
Curious, determined, and tireless.
Very good. If you could delete any word from the business jargon dictionary, what would it be?
Oh, there's so many of them. The first one that comes to mind is synergy. Oh, and my other one that I'm hearing a lot these days is keep your powder dry. Oh, that one just makes me go crazy. Anyway.
Yes. which leader, past or present, do you most admire?
Well, I think present, I look around the world, we're all looking at global politics. I think Jacinda Ardern is just, as a prime minister, I think the prime minister we all wish we had right now.
It's easy
to look at New Zealand because it's a smaller country, but I think what she's done to navigate the situation has been admirable, and she's just a great leader.
I couldn't agree more. And what's the best advice you've ever been given?
Well, when I first started working, I worked at NBC and GE much of my career. I got to work with Jack Welch, who was the CEO for a period of time. And he once called me into his office and told me to wallow in it. And I thought at the time, here's Mr. Speed, efficiency, every minute counted. And he was telling me that I wasn't taking enough time to get to know my colleagues, that I was too abrupt. And that was really good advice. And so every now and then when I go back to that being abrupt, he was so good. He was a good teacher in this. I'll tell you one little side story. I know this is a quick run, but he called me in. We had a long conversation. He said, wallow in it. And then 3 months later, I guess I wasn't heeding his advice. He called me on the telephone, my office phone. And I started to talk to him and the phone went dead. And I called his assistant. I was like, Jack, we got disconnected. She said, oh, no, you didn't get disconnected. He hung up on you. He wanted you to know that's what you sound like. So I it was a lesson I never forgot many years later.
That's a fantastic story. We might come back to Jack Welch a bit later on. Fascinating character. What's the best decision you've ever made?
The best decision I ever made was a personal one. Was deciding in my 20s that I was married, had a kid, and deciding that that path was not the one that was really where I was meant to be, and so took another path as a divorced single mother and kind of went forward. It was very traumatic, very tumultuous, very hard, but it was definitely a voice I listened to and a path that I had to make work after that.
And the final quick fire question, which is a question everybody always really wants to know the answer to, what's the worst decision you've ever made?
I've made so many bad decisions, and the business decisions, things that were supposed to work out, people I didn't hire on. I mean, I turned down the chance to go work at Apple twice. I did it for all the right reasons, but you might wonder about what, and you see where Apple's gone on. So that was probably, I did it for the right reasons, but you'd look at it from an opportunity perspective, I might've missed out on some things.
Yeah, I always think there's no such thing as good or bad decisions. There's just make some decisions and keep going. So let's get into it a little bit more then. So Beth, you described yourself in the past, I think, as an introvert, but have said, I had to learn to be successful in business, which is an extrovert's arena. Do you think leaders need to have a certain personality? And specifically, I guess, do you think either introverts or extroverts make better leaders?
Well, I think business is this extrovert arena. I believe that. And so it does tend to favor extroverts, the people who aren't afraid to speak up, who put themselves out there. That works against introverts. That being said, I think there are a lot of benefits to being an introvert. We can come back to that. But I think the best advice you can get is just to kind of what your mother told you, be yourself. And I had to learn that while I'm not naturally extroverted, there were times I had to step outside what was comfortable to me and play in that arena. So yeah, I'll give you an example. I go to a networking event. For business, that's important. You want to meet people. That's how business gets done. And for me, it would be easy to just go circle around the room and leave and go, yes, I was at the event. And I had to say, no, I am going to go and I'm going to meet somebody. I'm going to walk up. Hi, Chris. I'm Beth. And we'd probably have an inane conversation, but I did it and I could leave. And next time I would meet two Chris's and three and so on. So you just have
nobody wants to meet two Chris's.
My husband's Chris, so I like Chris.
Oh, there you go. We're three then. I find that fascinating because I have a deep terror of networking events, I have to say. And I used to work with somebody who is one of the greatest networkers I've ever met. And she used to tell me off and say, you know, you need to go and get out there. And I admire you for that story because I too find it really, really hard. Do you think that something you touched on about the fact that it's an extrovert's arena, do you think that it's possibly to the detriment of businesses sometimes that it is such an extrovert, he who or she who speaks up and shouts the loudest gets heard, and introverts, therefore, who might have brilliant ideas and be brilliant leaders get overlooked?
Absolutely. And largely it is a he who speaks loudest still in business, unfortunately. But yes, absolutely. As an introvert, I used to, there were times I would be like, I did not speak up in that meeting and I had a good idea and I would get mad at myself, or I had a question, but somebody else asked it before I did. And you just get so frustrated at yourself. So those are the things you have to train yourself. However, as somebody who's been managed and has overseen people who are introverts, here's what I think you need to think about. One, you need to make sure you have different styles of thinking and being on your team. That's like the first checklist as a team leader. With introverts, they aren't going to be the loudest. You may need to call on them and perhaps even in advance. Hey, Chris, I'd love to hear from you. So just giving you a heads up, I'm going to ask you to speak about XYZ during the meeting. Another role you can play with introverts is to say, hey, we've had a great conversation. Chris, can you synthesize and just kind of tell us what you think the key points are out of this meeting? I think introverts, as by nature, we're good listeners. We're good observers because we're not talking, so we're focused. And so often that means we're good observers. Another thing you can do is even after the meeting, you can say, hey, perhaps you didn't get a chance to speak here or you have some additional thoughts. I'd love to hear from you. Send me a note. Come by to see me as a way, again, to recognize people's different styles. Those would be the things the people who helped me come out of my shell did that. They'd be, hey, Beth, what do you think? Now, at first, it's like, oh, my God, don't call on me. Please don't. I'm not here. So you have to get over that because when they call on you, you actually have to speak. You can't say, I don't have anything right now. So the other thing I would say is if you're an introvert, go into every meeting having done your homework. What are two or three questions that you want to ask from your unique perspective? Don't try to talk about gap accounting if you're not an accountant. Talk about it from your perspective. I'm a marketer. Here's what's happening in the marketplace. Here's what the competition is doing. Something. And so you have to do your homework too, so that if the team manager calls on you, you don't go, I don't have anything. You've missed an opportunity.
And you are living proof that introverts make great leaders.
I think we do.
Just as well as extroverts.
I think we do because we listen. And I think one of the things to your other point is we are so busy talking and selling. And I mean, I'm sure you advise many of your clients. I always felt our agencies, the best agencies were the ones that knew us better than we knew ourselves. That requires a lot of listening. Yeah. And so I imagine you haven't gotten to where you are and Havas hasn't with you guys just going in selling yourselves all the time. You have to listen.
Yeah, yeah. I worked for somebody once and I obviously won't name check him. Somebody described him as, for him, listening was the silences while he waited to speak, which I think
I probably know
sums
him.
Up. Yeah, exactly. So you kind of just touched on this in the answer to your previous question, but you made history as General Electric's first female vice chair in 2015. Is it difficult being a female leader in a male-dominated industry? I might be able to guess at least partly your answer to that, but I guess more usefully, what strategies helped you succeed in that?
Yeah, I mean, it was great that I got to be the first female vice chair, but it's also kind of a tragedy that after a 130-year-old company, I had to be the first one. So long time coming. And yeah, there were challenges in being the only female voice often in a room, in a meeting, and being an introvert and some of the other things we talked about. Good leaders, to what we said earlier, need difference. They need difference in gender. They need difference in global experience, in styles, the way people think. And so too often you're not recognized of the value of your difference. You're just seen as not part of the crowd. What can you do about that? I mean, one, just persevere, just keep working on. I found at GE, we had groups like a women's network that ended up being very helpful for myself because it was a place to go and go like, am I crazy? Or did you have this happen? And how did you deal with it? So I find those groups are very helpful to just learn some techniques. And at the same time, once I got comfortable with the fact like, okay, I'm not changing that I'm a woman. I'm not trying to be one of the guys. I'm going to embrace it. It actually worked in my favor. In the sense that the difference gave me a differentiation, just quite literally. I was a woman and I could bring that point of view. In a boardroom, it used to be that there was a women's seat on the board. I mean, we've luckily progressed past that, but you were there to bring a woman's point of view. And so I just embraced that I have a point of view. I was different in a technology company being a marketer. I was different in an industrial company being out of media. And all those things, it took a while. I had to do a real confidence game with myself. But I just, suddenly it was this moment of, I'm different. And I'm going to kind of celebrate the difference and hopefully be a beacon for other people and hire other people who are different so we can create kind of squads of difference. And that worked for me. And it was more fun.
It sounds like you almost turned your difference into a virtue. A benefit, let's say. Do you think that the fact that you were different, that made it easier or more, let's say more likely that you hired, promoted, hunted out other people who might be different, whatever their difference was?
Well, I don't want to make it sound like it was easy in the sense, it just sort of, my headset got to the point, like, I can't change these things about me. So if I'm going to stay here and I like the work I'm doing and I'm going to succeed, I'm going to have to use the, you know, it's the marketer in you that goes, what's your unique value proposition?
Yeah.
So there's a certain amount of confidence journey you have to go on. And over time, it did make it easier to hire people who were different because other people weren't hiring them. So in some ways, why not? Again, we were marketing in a tech company, and it was easy to find people who had a different kind of perspective just by bringing in marketers. And I think as GE got more global, we hired, and I think that's great, was a great development at the company, many more global leaders. And now you think in companies, the idea, if you don't have a Indian leader in India, what's going on with you? So all of that, one thing that I think is progress that's happened in business that's much more, but so much more to do, so much more to do.
Let's talk about your book, Imagine It Forward. It's focused on leading change and specifically how to create an innovation-focused culture. It's a huge topic, obviously, but can you sort of summarize the central premise for us?
Yes, well, I took a different tact with the book. It's somewhat personal. I tried to document, especially earlier in my career, the challenges I had, lessons learned. So it's not a book that's just here's instant success, like follow these five steps and you'll be a genius. I didn't figure that out. I never reached genius status. It's tried, sweat, effort. Here's some things that worked and here's some things that didn't. But for me, it comes down to, I'll just touch on kind of three key things. I think one is just the power of giving permission and having an open culture that's a willingness to take a chance on taking risks, giving yourself permission, giving your team permission to try things. So with that is going to come failure. We can come back and talk about that, but that's often a challenge in companies. I think the second is just the ability to get out and discover what's happening in the world. Particularly challenging now, but I think you can zoom anywhere in the world and find anything, but get out and discover what's next, what's new, start to see trends, patterns, go where things are weird. I mean, most people don't think about weird being part of their job in business. And the third is just to get to action. I mean, in most companies, ideas aren't the problem. It's actually getting them activated on. And I, in particular, there's two things within that sort of sub-bullets. I would say the vision, the story, being, you know, any good strategy is really a great story. And you have to know how to tell a story to get people to follow you, to make change. And then the other piece is just that ability to try things, rapid test and learn, try, so that you're building up your confidence about what works. That's how you get good action.
And now I'm afraid it's the inevitable COVID question, which, you know, we spend all our lives talking about. Yeah, we have to have. Would you change any of the advice or any the way you'd approach the book if you were writing it now in our strange new world?
I called the book Imagine It Forward. And we're living in a time where few of us really took seriously that a virus was possible. So maybe just I'll take a minute and do a little thought experiment. I mean, hopefully this has trained us all to think differently. If I ask you now, you go to bed tonight and you wake up tomorrow or go to bed tonight saying, what's something I know is never going to change? I know it's never going to change. You wake up tomorrow and you find out, oh my God, it's changed. You know, how do you feel? How do you think about? Hopefully that's a different question to everybody now. The idea that we're not ever going to get on a plane for a 6-month period. We're not going to be in an office with one another. We're going to be doing video conferences. Our kids aren't going to be in school. I mean, on and on and on. Those were imponderables before. So I do think COVID hopefully has given us all a sense that we need more of a practice, if you will, about thinking through alternate scenarios. It's not saying that you're trying to bet the future or guess the future. You're just starting to not be so surprised that when it shows up, hey, I've thought about that. I have a way of approaching that. I don't know. How would you answer that, Chris? How would you answer that? You run a big company. You've had to think through all this.
Yeah, hoping you weren't going to ask me that. I think the fundamentals of leadership don't change as a result of COVID. But I do think that we, over the past, let's say 3 years, we've had four huge global events, which the Me Too movement, Extinction Rebellion, Black Lives Matter, and COVID, with any one of which I think would be a huge discontinuous social change. And taken together, they have put a whole load of issues right in the middle of the boardroom table for every single business. You know, and I think of those as humanity, ecology, and technology. And every single business needs to be thinking about those, and not just the preserve of the HR department or the sort of, the crisis management department or whatever. They have to, you know, the answer to those have to be part of the business strategy.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, there's a whole other discussion to be had. I mean, I think we are witnessing the end of many eras. It's hard when you're in the middle of it. You have to give yourself time to mourn for what you lost, for the dreams you thought were going to happen, the path, the job, the career you thought was going to happen, the company you thought. And then a good leader says, okay, like, we're going to feel bad about that, but we're also building the future. We're building possibly many different futures, and here's what they look like. And I love the way you wove in some of those tough challenges of our times. You have to be, as a leader, aware of those and listening, and the feedback loops. I think that's something that's changed a lot, certainly in the course of my career, the ability we all have. Frankly, you always had it, but frankly, there are no more excuses. Talk about no bullshit, no excuses for not having good feedback loops to know when your culture is challenged by things and you're not listening to it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. But I think the development of an effective organizational culture is, you know, arguably the key task, I think, for a leader. If you get it right, it's a superpower.
It really is.
But so difficult to do. Where do you stand on the great working from home debate? Where do you stand on that? And what do you think the challenges that throws up for leaders?
Yeah, I think it's both. It's and. People need the ability to work where they work best. From a creative innovation perspective, people need time alone and they need time in groups. As a leader, you're an orchestrator, you're a conductor, or, you know, creating this symphony. And so I believe you have to allow people room to work where they're best, most successful, and that may be home. I'd say the good thing I'm seeing from a lot of companies is all excuses are off the table. They can't say, well, we don't know if that's going to work in COVID, because no one's been in COVID. So companies are seemingly willing to take a lot more risk, which I love. But there is this bit of, well, we're all going to get back to the office, or we're never going to get back to the office. I don't think either of those are true. Someday there's going to be some melding, and hopefully it's a little bit of both and a lot more fluid. I do think we're entering much more a time of fluidity. Fluidity in terms of how we work and where we work is definitely going to be on the agenda.
Do you think COVID will be an accelerant or I guess the opposite, a retardant for innovation and for innovators?
I think it's an accelerant for the most part. You're always going to have usually in times of change. I mean, to me, the big thesis of why I felt to write the book was giving yourself permission, but just realizing that that you have to adapt and embrace change as the momentum you need to navigate change. And so too often people, especially in businesses with hierarchical structures and rules and processes, it's like, we'll just get through this and then we can go back to what we're doing. I believe COVID has challenged that thinking for most everyone. I just look here in the U.S. I mean, it's the simplest, stupidest thing, but I just noticed it this weekend. We have all these late night shows, the late night comedy shows, and they were so boring and formulaic. Everybody wore a suit and a tie and they sat behind a desk, and COVID happened and they were doing it in their in-laws attic, their basement, their whatever. They stopped wearing suits. They let their hair down. Now they're coming back to the studio and they're not wearing suits anymore. And they've morphed their show. And it's something so stupid as an innovation, like, I don't have to wear a tie, but they've freed themselves. And I think that's symbolic of what you're going to see many more people start to do. This is dumb. Why are we doing this?
It liberates people. As you said a few minutes ago, it allows you possibly to imagine different futures.
Exactly. And you must do that. I don't know, Chris,
I guess is the whole point of your book.
Well, and I wonder, with your view as leading such a big organization, I mean, I worry that in many organizations, you want to make change, like there's like your transformation officer, and often that's a digital officer, but you kind of relegate change to a department, or it's the strategy. Change is everybody's job. I mean, certainly it's the CEO's job, but I don't know if you need to put it in your job description, but hopefully everybody in the team feels that change is part of what they have to play a role in.
I think change is the CEO's job. If a CEO isn't doing that, I kind of wonder what they are doing. Because if you were standing still, you're going backwards. And that was true anyway. It's not like business was easy before, right? I mean, it was hard enough anyway, before COVID. And it's a thousand times harder now, I think. I think for many of us, we'll look at this time and think this is the hardest time of our careers. But at the same time, I think we can look around and we may not know who they are, but we know there are people who are making decisions now, making investments, starting businesses, making change that will transform their businesses for the good, transform them in a positive way off the back of this. And I suppose there'll also be those that don't.
I love the way you're saying that. I mean, to look at this as that one of those defining moments of a leader's history and that you can point to, and how did they come out of COVID? I mean, it's defining their story and their strategy in that reaction.
We have no choice as leaders, I suppose, but grab the moment. I mean, this is the hand we've been dealt. There's nothing any of us can do about it. So how do we find the positives in it? Which there are, strangely, but they're hard to find sometimes. And I guess we've got to keep ourselves positive to do that. Which actually leads me to something I think, again, you talk about. You say that fear is the number one thing that holds people back. What do you think people can do to overcome that? Have you got any examples of, I mean, you talked about your networking example. Have you got any examples of where you've done it?
Well, let me just answer first, what holds, why does it hold us back? Because people don't talk about it. I mean, you don't want to walk into your team and go, I have a confession, I'm afraid. I'm afraid we're not going to make the quarter. I'm afraid we're not going to beat the competition. I mean, there's certain things you might want to keep to yourself, but there are things you need to say, I don't know how to do this. We haven't done this before. That's why you're here. That's why we're here together as a team. We're going to figure this out. So I do think it takes a very humble leader to say, I don't know the answer. And I guess those would be the times when I think for myself, those times when I was afraid but just had to lean into it. I remember in GE when we were early on trying to get clean tech launched. We called it EcoImagination. It was a great marketing platform and also a very serious set of business intentions, but no one in the company except the CEO thought it was a good idea. It would have been so easy for him or me to go, no one likes this. I'm afraid it's not a good idea. I remember at one point, a customer, we had launched EcoImagination, and a big customer to GE, I mean, $100 million customer, that big, said, this is bad for the industry. I'm not going to give GE any more business. Jeff Immelt, the CEO at the time, never told us who were leading this effort, never told us, because he didn't want it to dampen our confidence, our courage, our force to move forward, because he believed there were going to be other customers who were going to find it. And we had enough data saying there were enough customers. So I think there are times as a leader, you can withhold some of that information to keep the team going. And at the same time, realize that there are opportunities out there that continue, that enough data points on you to keep going.
I love your example. I've thought for quite a long time that one of the most powerful things a leader can say is, I don't know. And I think Brené Brown, I think it is, who talks about the power of being able to be vulnerable and how powerful and how effective that can be. And I pine for politicians who are prepared to say, I don't know.
Yeah, if you find one, could you let us know? Maybe Jacinda is the only one. Why, yeah. She's on my list.
Maybe Jacinda. Yeah. Maybe Jacinda. Exactly. You know, we've got quite a lot here who don't know. They just won't admit it. That's the big problem.
Yeah, I know. We have our share of those too.
We got plenty of those. Yeah.
But you're right. How hard is it just to say, we don't know, but that's not going to keep us from trying A, B, C. And I loved sort of, as I went in my career, I wish I had learned this earlier, but just learning to ask better questions and being able to say, here's the hypothesis right now. I don't know for sure, but it's a hypothesis of why we think this is the right path. Until we get new information that tells us it's wrong, we're going to continue. That would be an easy thing for a politician to say. Don't know for sure. here's our hypothesis. We're going to go this path. And if it, if it's proven wrong, we'll pivot.
Absolutely. And I think also if you aren't saying it, how do you learn? How do you find out what's really happening? I often think on really, you know, you're talking about big strategic situations, but also I often think about people just sitting in meetings and somebody will be talking about something and you think, I don't think I understand what that person's talking about. And nobody says anything. And when the person does, everybody's so grateful because it turns out nobody understands.
But, you know, Chris, I think that's such a great point you're raising. I think just that's a no bullshit way to approach it. Just sometimes as a leader, or if you're asking the question, I'm sorry, can you just tell me what that word means? I remember when we were trying to launch digital at NBC and also at GE. I mean, words like platform. The digital cool kids knew what it meant. Other people didn't even know. And all it took was, here's what it means. Or often you say, I think of it as this. What do you think of it as? So I love what you're saying. And again, a good question can help get to the nugget of what people are trying to communicate.
You can't really solve a problem unless you're really clear about the nature of the problem you're trying to solve. And that's a really obvious thing to say. But often that's quite difficult to get to the heart of. And I think for me, that often can come back to things like honesty. You know, have you got a culture where people feel able to be honest with each other, with you? Do you feel able and have the courage to be honest with the people either you work for? That can be difficult sometimes, or the people that work for you. But unless you are, I think it's very difficult to make progress.
Yeah. So I think two good questions have bubbled up in our conversation. What's your hypothesis, and what you just said, what problem are you trying to solve? It's a really good question. You may be arguing and each talking about something totally different.
Exactly. And that often is the case. In an early podcast, we spoke to Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia. And he told us about a talk that he gives called Failure, Jimmy Wales is Good at It. What role has failure played in your career?
Well, he's a rare person in a lot of ways, but he's a rare person who would say, I'm good at failure. I've done my own informal surveying. Whenever I am with people and I say, who here likes to fail? No one raises their hand. So he's unique in that. So I think that is the first thing, is that most of us don't like to fail. To me, I had to come to learn that I think one of the competitive advantages as an employee, as a company, is how quickly can you learn? I'm a learner. I'm curious. And so to me, I had to recast failure as an ability to learn. I'm going to try this, and out of it's going to come some learning. And so that speed to learn as a competitive advantage, I think also is just a nicer way of saying fail so you can learn faster. And there are just ways to do that. So how might you think about doing that in the course of your daily life? I love having an experiment fund. When I led teams, when I worked in a company, depending on the budget year, ideally, it'd be 20% of our budget, time, people focused on experimental, trying new things. Maybe some year it's only 5%. Maybe you don't have any oversight of a budget, but you oversee people's projects. You can give people freedom of time to think, time to try new things. And I think that works in your personal life as well. Are you carving out 20% of your time to go and discover new things, new skills, new capabilities?
I love that you talk about learning. I think some of the best leaders I've ever worked with are just kind of voracious learners. They have a curiosity I don't mean necessarily in an academic sense. I just mean learning in any sense. But their ability to learn from success, learn from failure, learn from others, and adapt it and apply it, I think is a really great skill for effective leaders. Now, I've got two last quick questions for you. So what's next for you, Beth, after such an exciting and varied career? What's the next project?
A couple of things. One, I put out my book, and I've been taking some time just to invest in my own personal creativity. So I've been doing a lot more creative writing, some of the visual art I mentioned, a return to nature. I've been investing my time doing more nature-based things. I recently joined a team that's helping scale up some climate technology businesses. So I'm excited about that, something I feel very passionate about. So that's an entree back in. I continue on a couple of boards. So for me right now, just learning my way forward is the mode I'm in.
My final question, if you could pick one piece of advice to give to leaders who are people who are already in leadership positions or those aspiring to leadership positions, what would that advice be?
I think it would be you've got to give yourself permission to take a risk, to try something. Ask yourself why not. And that may sound like, well, that's great if you're just starting out. But often the people who ask that are the hardest to change that way are the people at the top of the organization. There's always an excuse. Oh, the investors won't let me. The board would never go for that. My CFO won't let me. How do you know if you don't try something? And I don't mean bet the company kind of things. I mean small things. Go do an experiment. Reach out to somebody, get some insight, get some learning. I do think that is, especially where we are right now, in uncharted territory. You're going to find somebody who went through the plague, the Spanish flu of 1921, 1920. I don't think so. So no one's been here. So why aren't you going to try something? And what a better time than now, because there's not any comparable time to say, yeah, I could have, you know, usually in companies, it's like, yeah, we tried that in 1982. Well, you don't have to listen to that right now.
I think that's fantastic advice. And I think that's a great point to end on. Beth, thank you so much. That really was fascinating.
Thanks, Chris. I really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you.
If only we could have had twice as long. And if you've enjoyed listening to our conversation, please do take a moment to subscribe to the No Bullshit Leadership Podcast and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And thank you all and goodbye.